Exploring the Word is brought to you by Reclaiming America for Christ and the Fairview Baptist Church in Edmond, Oklahoma.
We welcome you to the radio ministry of Fairview Baptist Church in Edmond. We invite you to join with us for today's Exploring the Word. Here's Pastor Paul Blair.
This is Pastor Paul Blair. Thank you for joining us for today's edition of Exploring the Word. Well, today we'll begin session 6 of our series, God's Providential Hand in America. Today we'll be dealing with the subject of the Declaration of Independence. And today's message will actually be a two-parter. We'll begin today and then conclude it with our next time we get together here at Exploring the Word. But let me begin by explaining a misunderstood or twisted fact about a foundation of our country. America was not founded by a bunch of rebels, and it wasn't a rebellion, and it wasn't a revolution. It was truly a war for independence. Over the years between the first immigrants, the Pilgrims and the Puritans, up through the Great Awakening, there were countless incidents where the King of England and the Parliament in England had taken away and broken constitutionally established rights of Englishmen here in the New World. Folks, those charters were established. Those were rules of law. They were equally binding to the King of England as they were to any citizen here in the colonies. The colonists were free to impose their own taxes. They were free to elect their own legislatures and make their own laws. They were under the authority of the King of England, but they were free Englishmen. Over history, there was established English law which forbid the housing of soldiers in the homes of citizens, which forbid the implementation of taxes without representation of the people. Those were established English laws. And time again, the King of England and the British Parliament broke the law, placing themselves above the law, and literally forced the colonists to either become enslaved or to declare their independence and fight for liberty. One of the last and most grievous acts was what was called the Declaratory Act, which basically allowed the Parliament to do whatever they wanted to do, including, as was rumored, and the rumors were valid and it was a genuine concern, the establishment of the Church of England over the 13 colonies in order to ensure cooperation and obedience among the colonists. Well, those of us that have been part of these last sessions, and hopefully you already knew that the primary factor that led the first immigrants to come here to the United States of America was religious liberty. And now here in the 1760s, they faced losing their religious liberty and the reestablishment of the Church of England. Well, it was all those things that led the colonists to make appeal after appeal, redress of grievances with the King and with Great Britain. And time again, those appeals fell on deaf ears. Finally, after blood had already been shed, the colonists and their elected leadership, as they had gathered in Philadelphia in what's now known as Constitution Hall, drafted and voted to declare independence from Great Britain. July the 4th, 1776, the Declaration of Independence. We will be continuing our series tonight on God's providential hand in America. Last week we talked about the events leading up to and the event of the First Continental Congress meeting in Philadelphia in September of 1774. Tonight we will look at the events leading from that up through and talk about the Declaration of Independence. 55 men representing the colonies had gathered at Carpenter's Hall in Philadelphia in September of 1774 to discuss how they should respond to the intolerable acts of King George III. As you recall, charters had been broken. Legislatures had been dissolved illegally by the king. Trade had been suppressed. Taxes had been levied without representation. And folks, when you take a possession from somebody else without asking them to have it, that is called stealing. Whether it is a criminal or whether that is a local government or federal government. Standing armies were housed in the colonies when there was no war and consequently no need of having a standing army there. There was no more trial by a jury of peers in the colonies. In fact, offenses were now tried in other colonies or even in Great Britain at great expense to the colonists. Truly, all of these rights, all of these things that had been broken unilaterally and illegally by England, were guaranteed to British citizens in the Magna Carta, in the 1628 Petition of Right, and also in the 1689 Bill of Rights, and also in the charters that the colonies had had with the mother country. But the last straw truly was the Declaratory Act, a declaration of the king's right to absolute tyranny and even the threat of the establishment of the Church of England in the colonies. These men met at Carpenter's Hall in Philadelphia for 7 weeks, finally adjourning on October the 26th, 1774. Well, were these men a bunch of rebels? Were they a bunch of hotheads? What kind of action did these revolutionary troublemakers take in the face of tyranny? They issued to England a simple letter of redress of grievances. They got together and spent 7 weeks writing a letter asking England to change course. General Gage, who was stationed in Boston as commander in chief of the British Army, observed the behavior of the colonists. This was recorded in the book, The Centennial History of America, which was published in 1875. He said this: he was greatly perplexed to know how to manage the people of Boston. It was clear to him that they intended to resist the injustice of the mother country, but they kept so carefully with the law that he could not take hold of their acts. They held meetings and discussed their grievances, but violated no law and discountenanced violence of all kinds. Ladies and gentlemen, they weren't rebels. They were seeking to right the grave injustices of which they were victims. They were following the law as established in England, petitioning the government for redress. Their redress of grievances reiterated the rights of Englishmen according to the established law and asked King George III in Parliament to cease violating the law and to restore their rights as Englishmen. In January of 1775, Parliament received this letter that had been drafted by the First Continental Congress. Upon receiving the letter, there were a great number of friendly members of Parliament that were sensitive to the Americans, knowing that our cause was right. Among them was the Earl of Chatham, who spoke on behalf of the Americans and made this appeal to Parliament. He said, "When your lordships look at the papers transmitted us from America, when you consider their decency, firmness, and wisdom, you cannot but respect their cause and wish to make it your own. For myself, I must avow that in all my reading, no nation or body of men can stand in preference to the General Congress at Philadelphia. The histories of Greece and Rome give us nothing to equal it, and all attempts to impose servitude upon such a mighty continental nation must be in vain. We shall be forced ultimately to retract while we can, not when we must. These violent acts must be repealed." King George, upon hearing of this speech, was furious. This attempt by the American colonies at peace and justice was ignored, and things in America continued to decline from that January 1775, progressing ultimately towards July the 4th, 1776. The colonies were now forbidden from fishing off Newfoundland, another attack on the economy in the colonies. General Gage, the commander-in-chief of the English armies in the northern colonies, fortified Boston. The colonists began gathering powder and arms and cannon and were organizing and preparing their militias if needed. In February of 1775, Parliament declared Massachusetts to officially be in rebellion. Virginia, upon hearing this news, had their House of Burgesses meet in 1775, late in March, to consider the subject of raising a militia. Being forbidden by the governor, appointed by the King of England, from meeting in the State House, they met at St. John's Church in Richmond. The location of this legislative meeting was actually the choir loft area for this particular church. And it was at this gathering that Patrick Henry got up and made his famous speech. Let me read an excerpt of it. He said, "We have petitioned, we have remonstrated, we have supplicated, we have prostrated ourselves before the throne and implored its interposition to arrest the tyrannical hands of the ministry and the Parliament.
Our petitions have been slighted. Our remonstrances have produced additional violence and insult. Our supplications have been disregarded, and we have been spurned with contempt from the foot of the throne. In vain, after these things, may we indulge the fond hope of peace and reconciliation. There was no longer any room for hope if we wish to be free. If we mean to preserve inviolate those inestimable privileges for which we have been so long contending, if we mean not basely to abandon the noble struggle in which we have so long engaged, in which we have pledged ourselves never to abandon until the glorious object of our contest shall be obtained, we must fight. I repeat it, sir, we must fight. An appeal to arms and to the God of hosts is all that is left to us. They tell us, sir, that we are weak, unable to cope with so formidable an adversary. But when shall we be stronger? Will it be next week or the next year? Will it be when we are totally disarmed and when the British Guard shall be stationed in every house? Shall we gather strength by irresolution and inaction? Shall we acquire the means of effectual resistance by lying supinely on our backs and hugging the delusive phantom of hope until our enemies shall have bound us hand and foot? Sir, we are not weak if we make proper use of those means which the God of nature hath placed in our power. 3 millions of people, talking about the entire population of the colonies, armed in the holy cause of liberty. And in such a country as that which we possess are invincible by any force which our enemy can send against us. Besides, sir, we shall not fight our battles alone. There is a just God who presides over the destinies of nations. For those of you that have been with us on Wednesdays as we're studying through the book of Daniel, do you think Patrick Henry was familiar with the book of Daniel? And who will raise up friends to fight our battles for us? The battle, sir, is not to the strong alone. It is to the vigilant, the active, the brave. Besides, sir, we have no election. If we were base enough to desire it, it is now too late to retire from the contest. There is no retreat but in submission and slavery. Our chains are forged. Their clanking may be heard on the plains of Boston. The war is inevitable. Let it come. I repeat it, sir. Let it come. It is vain, sir, to extenuate the matter. Gentlemen may cry peace, peace, but there is no peace. The war has actually begun. The next gale that sweeps from the north will bring to our ears the clash of resounding arms. Our brethren are already in the field. Why stand we here idle? What is it that gentlemen wish? What would we have? Is life so dear or peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty. Or give me death. What a speech. What courage, what conviction, what faith in Almighty God that they were on the side of right. Things continued to decline. From this speech in April, it was just weeks until General Gage, stationed in Boston, took decisive steps, sending troops across the Charles River to arrest Sam Adams and John Hancock and to capture rebel munitions rumored to be stored at Concord. That, of course, the night of Paul Revere's midnight ride. The next day, the first shots of the revolution were fired at Lexington, led by Pastor Jonas Clark and the Church of Lexington as they stood in the shadow of the steeple in Lexington Green. Before that day ended, 49 Americans had been killed, but the British suffered 273 killed, wounded, or missing. The battle was on. News of the battle spread throughout the colonies. So what was the Continental Congress response? They now gathered together again in Philadelphia, this time at Independence Hall. After blood had already been shed, and what was this group of rebels about to do? They wrote another letter requesting peace. Letter that's called the Olive Branch Petition. But these men were brilliant. They hoped for the best and still worked for peace and pursued peace, but they were preparing for the worst. And this Congress met again just 3 weeks after the Battle of Lexington and Concord on May the 10th, 1775. While there, they organized themselves into an official governing body over the colonies. They organized an official Continental Army. They placed George Washington as commander-in-chief, and they drafted and sent this olive branch petition to King George III. Notice how coy they were, how subtle they were, how crafty they were, how wise they were, as they were giving King George III the benefit of every doubt and the opportunity to save face at the same time. They phrased their letter as if Parliament was doing all these improper activities on the colonies, and that King George was ignorant of these criminal acts that were being perpetrated by the colonists. Well, not all of our founding fathers were in favor of this step, but 48 of the 56 members of Congress signed it, and on July the 5th, 1775, this olive branch petition went to England. While they were gathering, now remember the timeline. Battle of Lexington and Concord had already taken place. Congress was gathering in Philadelphia, crafting the olive branch petition. While this was going on, again, General Gage sought to break out of this hole as he was bottlenecked in the city of Boston. And the colonists had fortified the hills north and south of the city, and Gage sought to take the high ground to the north, what we know as Bunker Hill, or actually, more accurately, it was actually the Battle of Breed's Hill. There were 1,200 colonists gathered there, but they had limited ammunition. Americans were greatly outnumbered as General Gage sent 3,000 men, the finest military force on planet Earth, to place a frontal assault and hopefully chase these Americans off and let them know where they stood. Folks, the Americans were commanded by their commanding officer, because of their limited ammunition, don't fire until you see the whites of their eyes. We can't afford to waste shot and powder. We don't have enough. And 3,000 of the finest trained troops in the world marched up Breed's Hill. Fortunately, we had the high ground. But 3,000 combat experienced trained men against our group. We repulsed their first attack. They regathered, stunned that these farmers had the audacity to stand against them. We repulsed the second attack, and they were ready to withdraw, but they couldn't for pride. And finally, on the third attack, only because we ran out of ammunition, they were able to take the high ground, literally in hand-to-hand combat. But they paid a great price. Of the 3,000 redcoats, over 1,000 gave their lives that day, including Major Pitcairn, who was the villain of the Battle of Lexington. Now, while all this was taking place, the olive branch petition, remember, we didn't have email back in this day. The olive branch petition was signed in Philadelphia and sent by ship to England, arriving in England on September the 21st. King George III refused even to receive it. And on the 23rd, he declared that the colonies were in open rebellion. Tensions continued to rise as both sides prepared for war. Conflicts continued, and in March 1776, General Washington, in a brilliant maneuver, brought cannon cross-country in the middle of winter from Fort Ticonderoga and placed them on Dorchester Heights, assuming the high ground and taking control of Boston, and the British were forced to leave. Folks, it was now obvious. The separation from England was unavoidable. Now in June, as the Continental Congress was continuing to meet, recognizing that their last letter, the olive branch that they had extended to King George, had been refused, a resolution in Congress to dissolve their political connection with Great Britain was offered by Richard Henry Lee, a delegate from Virginia. It was seconded by John Adams, a delegate from Massachusetts. This debate was fierce, barely passed to discuss the crafting of a document for separation with a vote of 7 states to 6 states. Richard Henry Lee made this impassioned speech. He said, "Why then, sir? Why do we no longer delay? Why still deliberate? Let this happy day give birth to an American republic. Let her arise not to devastate and to conquer, but to reestablish the reign of peace and law." What were these men trying to do? They were trying to reestablish the law, ladies and gentlemen. I hope we understand the danger that even we live in this generation. Modern secular humanism teaches that man is by nature good. No, he's not. Bible says that man is sinful by his very nature. And man can't be trusted. And a tyrant will most certainly trample the rights of the citizenry at the loss of great blood. Consider the history in the recent century of Russia, the tens of millions that were murdered in a tyrannical government. Consider the last century and recent history in communist China, the tens of millions that were murdered under a tyrannical government. These men knew what they were doing. They were trying to reestablish law in the face of a tyrant who was the one that was guilty of breaking the law. They weren't rebels. King George had rebelled from English law and from the colonial charters. Lee went on to say, "The eyes of Europe are fixed upon us. She demands of us a living example of freedom that may exhibit a contrast in the felicity of the citizens to the ever-increasing tyranny which desolates her polluted shores. She invites us, Europe does, to prepare an asylum where the unhappy may find solace and the persecuted repose. If we are not this day wanting in our duty, the names of the American legislators of 1776 will be placed by posterity at the side of all those whose memory has been and ever will be dear to virtuous men and good citizens." And most certainly, those names have been placed there. Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, and Roger Sherman and Robert Livingston were assigned to the committee to draft the Declaration. It was reported to Congress on June the 28th, drafted largely by Jefferson, but with many verbal alterations. The declarations gave a clear and comprehensive explanation of their actions. It was passed on July 2nd, unopposed, and the final version was adopted on July the 4th, 1776. Copies were commissioned to be printed and spread throughout the land, and the first public reading was on July the 8th. Read with me. Having understood the background of all these things that have taken place in these first five lessons that we've done on God's providential hand in America, read with me this declaration. When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitled them. By the way, we'll come back and define that momentarily. A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, which, by the way, that's exactly what Romans 13 says. And these governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. It's of the people, by the people, and for the people. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its power in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly, all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies. And such is now the necessity which constrains them to alter their former systems of government. The history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. He has refused his assent to laws, the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. He has forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance unless suspended in their operation till his assent should be obtained. And when so suspended, he has utterly neglected to attend to them. He has refused to pass other laws for the accommodation of large districts of people unless those people would relinquish the right of representation in the legislature, a right inestimable to them and formidable to tyrants only. He has called together legislative bodies at places unusual, uncomfortable, and distant from the depository of their public records for the sole purpose of fatiguing them into compliance with his measures. Boy, sounds like much what we're dealing with today, doesn't it? Trying to wear us out, so we'll just give up. He has dissolved representative houses repeatedly for opposing with manly firmness his... I love that. These that opposed him like men. He said he has dissolved these representative houses repeatedly for opposing with manly firmness his invasions on the rights of people. He has refused for a long time after such dissolutions to cause others to be elected, whereby the legislative powers, incapable of annihilation, have returned to the people at large for their exercise, the state remaining in the meantime exposed to all dangers of invasion from without and convulsions from within. He has endeavored to prevent the population of these states, for that purpose obstructing the laws of naturalization of foreigners, refusing to pass others to encourage their migrations here, and raising the conditions of new appropriations of lands.
We thank you so much for joining us for today's edition of Exploring the Word, and hope that you'll tune in next time as we conclude this message on the Declaration of Independence. Well, if you're enjoying this series on God's providential hand in America, we'd invite you to purchase a copy of it for your very own. We have it available on CD for $19.95, all 12 sermon series set, and on DVD for $29.95, also all 12 sermon series set. If you'd like more information about this product, you can call us at Fairview Baptist Church. The number is 405-348-1745, and we can make arrangements to get a copy out to you. This is wonderful teaching material. You can teach it to your kids. You can watch it at home. You can use it in a small group or even an adult Bible class or Wednesday night services as a wonderful series on God's providence in America. I hope that you'll take advantage of this, the time and effort that went into this, and we hope that this is a blessing to you and also to those across America. Well, again, we thank you for being a part of our ministry here at Exploring the Word, and we look forward to being with you next time as we continue our series on God's providential hand in America. Until then, God bless you.
You've been listening to the teaching ministry of Fairview Baptist Church in Edmond. We hope that today's journey in God's Word has been a blessing to you. You can find more sermons and resources at our church's website, www.fairviewbaptistedmond.org, or call 405-348-1745. Join us again each weekday for Exploring the Word from Fairview Baptist Church in Edmond.